You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show, from Scotland to Iran, Ukraine to Iraq, we'll talk through the day's top news with Tim Marshall and John Everard here in the studio. We'll also look at the week's new films.
I write. I eat.
I probably had more meals with you than my wife.
I watch TV.
Awesome.
This is my 20,000th day on Earth.
Including the new Nick Cave biopic, 20,000 Days on Earth, and we'll find out what David Lynch was doing before he was David Lynch.
Painting has really been the through line in David Lynch's work from the beginning. It's what his first love was. He never put it on the back burner or took a divergent route that was just filmmaking. I think you could see that in the sensibility of his film.
We'll also catch up with our correspondent in Brussels and play you some music as well. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, right now. So, loads coming up in the next 58 and a half minutes here on Midori House. But ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the world news.
Alex Salmond, the most vocal politician in favour of Scottish independence, is to step down as First Minister of Scotland after voters decisively rejected independence in Thursday's referendum. He will also resign as leader of the Scottish National Party. Over 55% of Scottish voters rejected a call to leave the United Kingdom. Earlier, Salmond said the call for change was clear and he was proud of how the vote was conducted.
As we bring Scotland together, let us not dwell on the distance we have fallen short. Let us dwell on the distance we have travelled and have confidence that the movement is abroad in Scotland that will take this nation forward, and we shall go forward as one nation. Thank you very much.
Well, the British Prime Minister David Cameron said the result settled the issue of Scottish independence for a generation. He said the result paved the way for a new balanced constitutional settlement for all of Britain.
Record numbers registered to vote and record numbers cast their vote. We should all be proud of that. It has reminded us how fortunate we are that we're able to settle these vital issues at the ballot box peacefully and calmly. Now we must look forward and turn this into the moment when everyone, whichever way they voted, comes together to build that better, brighter future for our entire United Kingdom.
Other news now. The World Health Organization said on Friday that the killing in Guinea of eight people trying to educate locals about Ebola showed how much rural populations in West Africa mistrust authorities after years of instability and conflict. Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone are reeling from the Ebola epidemic that has killed at least 2,630 since March, including eight people in Nigeria, according to WHO figures. Barack Obama has welcomed Washington's approval for his plan to train so-called moderate Syrian rebels. The $500 million plan forms part of the US president's strategy to defeat Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria. Several senators from both parties had expressed their fears that the measure could lead to a slippery slope, but South Carolina's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said the Syrian rebels could be trusted.
To my colleagues who worry about the people we train and the arms we give falling into the wrong hands, I would say there's nothing we can do in this area without some risk. But when you tell me there are no Syrians that you believe exist that would fight against Assad and ISIL, I don't believe you quite understand what's going on in Syria.
The U.S. oil company ExxonMobil said on Friday that the U.S. Treasury Department has granted it a license to wind down operations on a drilling well in the Kara Sea in the Russian Arctic that has been targeted by U.S. sanctions. Washington intensified sanctions on Russia last week to punish Moscow for its intervention in Ukraine. And finally, in the United States, a dog that went missing in Philadelphia, that's in Pennsylvania, 5 months ago, has turned up 3,000 miles away in Oregon at an animal shelter in Portland. Officials say they've no idea how the Jack Russell Terrier, named Gidget, made the cross-country trip. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's 18:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We will be back right after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 18:06 near enough in London, which will be 13:06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, I have Tim Marshall, diplomatic editor for Sky News, recently author of A History of the British Football Chant entitled You Dirty Northern Bastards, and John Everard, former British ambassador to Pyongyang, Minsk and Montevideo, author of the North Korean memoir Only Beautiful Please. Welcome both. We will start here in the United Kingdom, which, after a period of somewhat frenzied doubt, remains exactly that. By a margin of 55-45%, residents of Scotland have decided that the 307-year union is worth persisting with. Earlier this afternoon, Alex Salmond, Scotland's First Minister and the prime mover behind the independence bid, announced his intention to stand down. Tim, I'll ask you first, the latest news on this, which is Alex Salmond's announcement that he will resign not only as First Minister but leader of the Scottish National Party. Does that surprise you?
No, because, you know, somebody's got to take the fall and take the blame, and he was the one who pushed the agenda all the way and led it, and most people say led it, obviously not very effectively at the end, but he led it very well insofar as they put together a very good campaign, did a lot of homework on the economic argument, which I think was the key, also did a fairly good thing of appealing to the emotion, but clearly it wasn't enough, and he's got to give someone else a chance now. I think also there is the human aspect of exhaustion. He's probably exhausted.
I would imagine emotionally and physically absolutely shattered after a campaign like that. And obviously for Salmond, whatever one thinks of him and the idea of Scottish independence, it was very much his life's work. But John, 55-45 is it's a respectable margin, which I'm sure is a massive relief to certainly the political establishment in Britain, who were probably dreading a close no vote as much as they were dreading an actual yes vote. But was it ever really in doubt? Did everybody just overreact to one slightly anomalous poll a couple of weeks out?
Various people in this room are nodding their heads. Yes, I agree. I think there was a certain amount of reaction. If you, in the cold light of morning, and it's easy to say this, isn't it, after we know what the answer is, but you can see that the no vote was ahead by a large margin from the outset. 64 polls, I think, were taken.
That's right.
And the only one to put that lead in any doubt was the famous, or the infamous, YouGov poll just a few days ago that sent the Westminster establishment into such a tiz. And I think that the giveaway that only a few brave pollsters dared to poke to at the end was that in a vote of this kind, you expect the number of don't knows to go down fairly steadily as voting day approaches. In this case, this did not happen. Something between 17 and 20% of the electorate were still saying close to the end that they had not made up their minds. Now, I suspect, and so do others, that what had happened was that the yes vote had created a climate where you didn't want to admit publicly that you were going to vote no. And there was an awful lot of hidden no vote in that supposedly undecided tranche.
I remember there was a conventional wisdom about this, but after the slightly surprising result in the 1992 general election, when people seemed to not want to tell opinion pollsters they were going to vote Conservative and then went out and voted Conservative.
Yes, I think that's another example of the same phenomenon.
There are some weird quirks among the vote when you break it down. Tim, Glasgow, Scotland's biggest city, voted yes. What does this tell us about how divided Scotland is, especially between, I mean, people who know both cities, Glasgow and Edinburgh, know that they're very, very different cities, and indeed they take a certain amount of pride in that difference. But what have we learnt about that difference?
Well, it's dangerous territory because, one of the splits is that there is a higher degree of professionals and highly educated people in Edinburgh, but I don't think the vote is on along those lines. And B, there is the Protestant Catholic divide, which is greater in Glasgow, I think, than it is in Edinburgh. And I think both of those factors may have played into it. I don't think we're going to find out until tomorrow when we really start to drill down into each city, But you can make the same argument about Aberdeen. Aberdeen is an oil town. Aberdeen was expected to vote overwhelmingly yes, and in fact voted overwhelmingly no. So forgive me for not being able to give you a full answer. I think we have to drill down into each individual of the 32 constituencies tomorrow and look at the splits and look at who voted which way and why, because I haven't got the info yet to really make a judgment.
There was one constituency, of course, quite famously voting for the first time in this election, which was 16 and 17-year-olds were extended the vote. They tended to vote yes. And I guess the question is whether that's indicative of a generational shift or indicative of that general teenage inclination towards iconoclasm.
Well, it's the kind of point you can debate without conclusion for a very long time. My take for what it's worth...
Or even for a couple of minutes.
Or even a couple of minutes. My take for what it's worth is that it is just a fact of being young, that you vote for change, that you are attracted by this. At the other end of the spectrum, older people tended to vote much more no than yes.
Indeed. Because they're worried about the economy, which I think was the crucial argument. Mm. If you say that part of it was an emotional vote, some people get cross and say, no, I was voting absolutely with my head. But I don't think there's anything wrong with admitting that part of it is emotional. And a love of country and patriotism and nationalism, whatever you want to call it, is partly, it's very emotional. And I do think that the younger voters probably did have that emotion, and I don't mean that in a condescending way. The thing I've taken from this more than anything is what a wonderful election it was, and how brilliantly the Scottish electorate engaged with it right across all sides.
Turnout was incredibly high.
Above 80%. Yeah. But the other thing is I'm interested in what is the knock-on effect, for this country, but also what is the knock-on effect in Macedonia, which has a small independent thing, Kosovo, what about Catalonia and all the others? They all watched. I think the effect would have been bigger if Scotland had said yes, then that you could have got a roll going in places like Catalonia. But as it's no, it might be less.
I think there were a lot of nervous onlookers in Madrid. Yes.
A lot of nervous onlookers in Madrid. I've just flown in from the Netherlands, and there was one province of the Netherlands that wanted to follow Scotland's example and declare independence. So anyway, this spreads wide. I think there's more to come. I think as we get down to the nitty-gritty of the famous package that the three Westminster political leaders put in the Scottish media on Tuesday, that the Catalans and others will start to watch yet again what is happening in the United Kingdom and start to bang a lot of doors in Madrid.
I won't give you too long a list, but you've got Nagorno-Karabakh over in the famous Nagorno-Karabakh, places like Armenia, Azerbaijan. Spain is a very good example. I wasn't even aware of the one in the Netherlands. You name a country in Europe and there will be a separatist movement of greater or smaller scale.
But on that subject, you mentioned the sentimental aspect of the vote, and you also mentioned the sectarian divisions in Glasgow in particular. How confident can we be that after this referendum, that will settle, that nothing's been stirred up? Nationalism, especially European nationalism, is live ammunition.
Well, again, one of the great things you take from this is, I've covered many separatist movements, and this is the first one where they haven't been shooting each other. And I don't see any reason why they're going to go down that. I think it will be a bit difficult. There'll be the odd fight in a pub or two on Friday, Saturday nights where people argue and realise that, I'm with someone from the other side. And some newspapers might make too much of that. But I can't see Scotland really going down that track. By the way, very, very briefly, I was in Bournemouth on Tuesday night watching my club Leeds United play, and there was a song, Land of Hope and Glory, Yorkshire Shall Be Free. I don't think they mean it.
Oh, good Lord. We shall move, bracing ourselves for Yorkshire's bid, followed doubtless by Cornwall, the Isle of Wight and Rockall. But we will move seamlessly now from a settled issue to a possibly unsettleable one. France has today made its first active contribution to the international campaign against the Islamic State. Rafael jets belonging to the French Air Force blew up what they said was an IS depot in northwestern Iraq. France has promised there'll be more where that came from. But, John, I'll ask you first. France have said they won't hit targets inside Syria. Are they doing that slightly typically French thing of having their baguette and eating it at this point?
Well, it's not just the French who do this, is it?
Well, indeed.
I think the hesitation over Syria, I think, is entirely understandable. It took the United States some time to come round the idea of strikes actually in Syria itself. And it's not surprising that the French are still sort of meditating on the possibilities. It's interesting, too, that the British, of course, would be the other power who traditionally would come in behind the United States in these situations, have said that strikes in Iraq, yes, quite possibly, but I think they described strikes in Syria as difficult, which in British diplomatic terms is quite strong.
The timing was interesting. General Dempsey, chief of staff, was in Paris yesterday and today, and lo and behold, the French Air Force goes into action in support of the American military in Iraq. I think what is also going on the Syria question, and that's true of all the countries, but especially led by the Americans, there is now an understanding that if you go into Syria, the Iranians will be absolutely furious. And at the moment, the nuclear talks, I wouldn't say they're on the knife edge, but
they're back on.
Now, Iran is quite happy to turn a blind eye in Iraq, an area it thinks is its backyard, to airstrikes on the Islamic State in Iraq. But if they go up against them, if the Western powers start bombing in Syria and destroy them, and then the other opposition becomes so powerful it overthrows Assad, then their client state has gone. And I think there is probably a nod and a wink and an understanding. We won't go in heavy in Syria. We're not going to disturb that equilibrium. And let's stay friends and cooperate the way we need to do in Iraq and on the nuclear talks with Iran.
But isn't the reality, and just sticking with you, Tim, that there's no way that you can seriously do anything about the Islamic State, if indeed people are serious about it, without striking them in Syria? And actually, there's arguably no way you can do it seriously just from the air.
I think you can at very least hold the line. I mean, you and I have been here 6 weeks ago talking about can the line be held? And we said at the time, once you start arming the Kurds and once you start the airstrikes, you will hold the line. And the line has now been held, and I think they will and can be degraded. I accept your point about it possibly can't be done unless you destroy them in Syria, because otherwise they can just melt away back into Syria and come backwards and forwards. Nevertheless, you're not just dealing with this one issue. There is the Syrian issue, and then there is the Iranian nuclear talks issue. They are all connected. And as I said, I really think that at the moment the Americans need the Iranians. They need them. They need them in Iraq on side, and they need them on the nuclear talks on side. And if you start bombing inside Syria in a really big way, and you destroy them, and the other opposition then destroys Assad, you've lost the Iranians, and you need the Iranians elsewhere.
We'll come back to the Iranian talks in more detail in the next few minutes. But John, Barack Obama was talking about putting this coalition together. We now have the French who have actually launched raids. The UK has talked about it, or at least hasn't ruled it out. Australia has sent 10 F-18s and 600 associated troops to the region, which probably isn't just for decoration. But ultimately, is this going to end up being one of those things, a bit like I was saying at the start of this item, where everybody lets America take both the literal and diplomatic flak?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm sure that a lot of other Western states would love that to be the case. But I think once you go in bombing people, you know, Islamic State will set up a hectotis and will retaliate. Mm. I mean, I don't know if they hold French hostages, but if they are, they're not safe anymore.
They have held French hostages, and the French government and certainly French corporations were paid to have them extricated.
But the fight's on, Andrew. The Americans stepped up and asked for help, and there are very few countries, especially the British, that when the Americans ask, say no. I mean, the British are sort of prevaricating a little bit. People are going to step up. This is going to be a long 10-year battle. People have woken up to the dangers of basically the oil supply in Iraq and the destabilization of the whole region, including Saudi Arabia. And the game is on. And I don't think this is going to be half-hearted. I think it's going to be fairly targeted and clever. Now, I think the Western policy has been awful for years and years, and they've got lots and lots of things wrong, including the so-called Arab Spring and how to react to it. But on this one, I think they've learned from their past mistakes, thought we're not going to blindly blunder in here and go off on a policy which we can't extricate ourselves from. They are inching forward, and so far most of the moves they've made have been, I think, fairly smart.
Okay, well, we'll take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, joined by Tim Marshall from Sky News and former British diplomat John Everard. We'll be back right after this, looking at Ukraine and those Iranian nuclear talks.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds.
from industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around. That's The Entrepreneurs every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Global affairs, culture, business, design, or urbanism, at Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas, or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Tim Marshall and John Everard. Now, 2 weeks ago, parties to the conflict in Ukraine met in Minsk and agreed a ceasefire, which did little to cease the firing. Today, representatives of Ukraine, Russia, and other interested observers will reconvene in the same location for another attempt to end the fighting, which has now killed approximately 3,000 people. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has been in Washington, where he told Congress in proper old-school Cold War style that if Russia is not stopped now, it will spread through Europe and across the globe, though citizens of Tahiti can probably delay panicking for a while yet. John, the US has said, however, it will send $46 million in non-lethal aid, whatever that means, blankets and night vision goggles, according to President Poroshenko, but they won't send Ukraine any guns. Why not?
Because there's no point. Money, as they say, is fungible. If you send these guys $46 million in, what, goggles? Fine. That's $46 million less they have to spend on goggles and more that they can spend on guns. So effectively, the money gets spent on guns in the end. It's just on the check.
It is a somewhat nonsense phrase, non-lethal aid in this context, isn't it?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, any aid to an army is, in that sense, lethal aid.
Is Poroshenko, with that statement, Tim, slightly overselling Russia's ambitions, do you think?
Ever so slightly. As you say, I don't think Tahiti's quaking in its boots. I don't think Russia does, under Putin, want to expand much further than Moldova, the Baltic states, most of Ukraine. So, I mean, he's not overstating it in that sense. He went a little bit too far with taking over the whole world. But at the moment, I think it's heading towards a frozen conflict. And I think that suits the Russians. And I think the Russians are still ahead of the game the way they have been all year.
Just following up on that point, Tim, and let's hope we're not doing the show in Russian 6 months from now. I will remind you of that prediction. That frozen conflict you mentioned, do you think at this point that the West, though it's obviously not going to admit it, has pretty much resigned itself to, you know, that's what's going to happen, that this is going to be like Georgia on a much grander scale. There'll be a permanent Russian presence, masquerading as peacekeepers or, you know, assistants or whatever it is they call themselves.
Crimea is game over and it's slam dunk for the Russians. There's actually fairly small parts of eastern Ukraine. People say, oh, well, you know, they've lost eastern Ukraine. The separatists are only in two relatively small parts of eastern Ukraine, and as far as I understand the deal, it's a 3-year self-rule for the two areas, in which time people can start making their minds up about what you want. Now, the reason I think that the Russians are still ahead of the game is that I think they will use those 3 years better than Ukraine will. One of the reasons, they've got more money, and they'll pile stuff and influence into those two regions, and they will probably engineer a referendum, and they will try to break away, and Russia will still be slightly ahead. But the big victory for me for Russia is, and forgive me, I think this is the third time I've said this to you, they have made Ukraine look both ways. They have stopped, I mean, I know there's a big trade deal they've just done with the EU, the Ukrainians. Nevertheless, they know they can't go too far. They know they have to keep paying at least some respect and attention to Russia. So the Western powers that were trying to drag Ukraine into its sphere of influence, I don't think have, well, they haven't succeeded by a long way, and they've scared themselves to pieces, and they've had to make some very belligerent statements about the Baltics. I know you've just been to the Baltics, saying we will defend the Baltics. They've had to make those statements, and the Russians are still poking away at those countries.
John, is there any diplomatic leverage that hasn't been applied to Russia by now that could usefully be?
Not in the short term, but I let me say that I disagree with virtually everything Tim has just said. You need to draw the camera back a bit, take a wide angle on this. To achieve his aims, Putin needed a short, sharp victory. If he lets things go into the long term, he has lost. Russia cannot sustain this long term. Russia is in a mess. Its economy is on a knife edge. Mm-hmm. He's got dissent internally. And he's now trying to pay for yet another frozen conflict. These things cost serious money that Putin does not have. In 3 years, I've no idea what will happen, but I doubt very much if Putin is any longer, if he's still in power or still alive, going to be in control of the eventual outcome. The West was not reaching out trying to pull Ukraine in. The last thing the West wanted was for Ukraine to suddenly switch and
for, was that why they were funding all the opposition groups? Was that why the Germans were training people in Berlin in politics and all the rest of it, and they were throwing money at them?
No, that is because the West at that stage was doing to Russia what Russia is now trying to do back to the West. You create an unstable Ukraine that Russia can never completely control. The idea that Ukraine would actually break away completely and join the Western camp was no part of the game plan. And the Great Revolution, the Maidan protest and everything, actually caught a lot of the Western observers completely by surprise. But okay, it's happened. And, you know, decency and the EU Charter and other worthy things. Yes, okay, you're rolling your eyes, but these things do actually count for something. You know, have to be observed. And we are now faced with Ukraine that wants to move west. It's being held by the Russians. And announcing that you've got this, it's more than just a trade deal. I mean, this is a fairly significant political document, that you've now got this new relationship with the EU on the same day as the ceasefire is ratified. Of course, it was theatre politics. This was a slap in the face of Putin, and Putin has not reacted. He can't.
We are going to have to look very quickly, just before the bottom of the hour, at the on the subject of challenging diplomatic conundrum. We're now 2 months, more or less, from the alleged deadline for a comprehensive agreement over Iran's nuclear program. The G5 plus one talks were supposed to resume this week on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in New York. John, you have some experience of dealing with slightly difficult, truculent nations with, you know, semi-legal, in fact, entirely illegal nuclear programs. November 24th, this deadline, is there going to be an agreement?
No, of course not. I mean, I think that is now patently clear. But then again, I think, you know, this talk of a deadline of an agreement in a year was a piety to start with. You set out these great roadmaps and everyone goes ooh and ah, but nobody's actually particularly surprised where they don't quite work. The key point is that the guys are still talking. This process is going to go on and on and on. The matters at stake are extremely difficult. There's, you know, Iranian national pride and aspirations bound up. You know, there's all the techie stuff over what we do with the Arak reactor, even if we can reach political agreement on decommissioning. And the, you know, the idea that you're going to wrap this up in a few weeks, frankly, is risible. Can I just make one other point? You've already linked quite rightly the nuclear talks resuming today with Syria and how Iran might react if there are strikes there. In talks like this, the coffee breaks are vitally important. Yeah, I mean, these guys will be sitting there in formal session across a table, exchanging positions over the Iranian nuclear program. But when they get together with the microphones off, there'll be an awful lot of talk about Syria, where the red lines are, what can be done, what can Iran live with, and what solution has Iran got then to IS?
Tim, final and unfortunately relatively brisk thought from you on this. Mike, you mentioned earlier that Syria and what's happening there alters the equation here fairly dramatically. Might Iran be thinking that maybe their position is a lot stronger than it was a year ago? What with Syria, Ukraine, Gaza, etc., they may be able to get stuff under the radar that they couldn't have.
I think it's a truism in international relations that powers have limited capacity to concentrate on more than one crisis at a time. And in that respect, yes, it has help the Iranians that everybody's looking at multiple crises on multiple fronts. I agree absolutely they'll bust through the deadline. The deadline was actually July 24th or 25th, and they bust through that. They'll bust through this one, but they will keep talking. The agreement last November in Geneva was a solid framework, if you can make it stick. But that they will be talking, and it's precisely because of the coffee breaks. Precisely because of the coffee breaks that they know they're going to keep that going, because there's an awful lot to talk about. And the grand bargain between the United States and Iran, the end of the 35 years enmity, you can just see it very vaguely in the distance now.
Well, you have both earned yourselves a coffee break on that note. Tim Marshall, diplomatic editor for Sky News, John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, Belarus and Uruguay. Thank you both very much for joining me. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Monocle 24 дес.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still coming up in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be checking in with our correspondent in Brussels. We'll be in Pennsylvania for a bit of David Lynch. And then we'll be reviewing four new films with one of our resident critics here in the studio. Ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the headlines.
Thank you very much. Alex Salmond, the most vocal politician in favour of Scottish independence, is to step down as First Minister of Scotland after voters decisively rejected independence in Thursday's referendum. The British Prime Minister, David Cameron, said the results settled the issue of Scottish independence for a generation. The World Health Organization has said today that the killing in Guinea of eight people trying to educate locals about Ebola showed how much rural populations in West Africa mistrust authorities after years of instability and conflict. Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone are reeling from the Ebola epidemic that has already killed 2,630 people since March. Barack Obama has welcomed Washington's approval for his plan to train so-called moderate Syrian rebels. The $500 million plan forms part of the US president's strategy to defeat Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria. And the US oil company ExxonMobil said today that the US Treasury Department has granted it a license to wind down operations on a drilling well in the Russian Arctic. Washington has intensified sanctions on Russia last week to punish Moscow for its intervention in Ukraine. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time is 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, 14:32 in Rio. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents, and today we are heading to Brussels. Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson joins us now. Charlotte, Brussels was presumably up all night watching the Scotland referendum results. How have they taken the result?
Yes, I think a lot of the Eurocrats were on the edges of their seats overnight because there was really genuine fear here in Brussels that if the verdict had gone yes, it was just going to open up the floodgates for all these other small, medium and large separatist movements across Europe. And you're looking at Italy, you're looking at Belgium, you're looking at Spain in particular. So certainly there was like a big collective sigh of relief, I think, when it turned out to be a no vote this morning.
There was, of course, a lot of talk that a yes vote for Scotland might embolden any number of breakaway regions in Europe. And as we were discussing earlier in the programme, there are a great many. The Basque Country, Catalonia, only the two most obvious ones. Now that the result's gone the other way, is there any discussion yet about whether that will discourage those liberation separatist movements or calm them down somewhat?
There seems to be two schools of thought on this. I think, well, the one in Spain is quite a unique situation because I think that's got its own momentum now, and I think that will be going on regardless of what happens in Scotland. Skeptics say, well, this Scottish referendum might have set a precedent for how it would go ahead, and that's not a good thing. But at the same time, I think generally, it's a feeling that unity won the day. And if you think about the EU and the troubles they've had this year with the European Parliament elections, and there's a real surge in support for nationalist parties and anti-EU and Eurosceptic parties, any sign that actually somebody wants to stick together is really welcomed here, especially in light of the potential British exit somewhere down the line as well.
Well, let's look now at Belgium's domestic politics. And I like you, I know you've been enjoying Belgium's ongoing inability to actually have a government as such. I'm almost disappointed by a suggestion that this long standoff may be approaching an end.
I know. And I think it's 116 or 17 days now that they haven't had a government, which may sound like a long time, but that's pretty possibly snappy compared to the 541 days it took them in 2010. So, yes, it looks like there has been a word that it might be formed by the end of this month. So I think there's a lot of expectation and hope in Belgium. And this time it looks like a four-party coalition, which is slightly more tidy than the six-party coalition we had last time. And significantly, for the first time, this coalition would include the NVA. And that's the, going back to the separatist issue, that's the party that pushes for eventual independence for the northern region of Flanders. So, yeah, an interesting time for Belgium ahead, I think.
Is there any indication yet of who might end up in charge?
Yes, well, there was a poll out recently by a couple of the leading Francophone media outlets, and they found that the current immigration minister was popular. Now, she's a woman called Maggie de Blok, and she's Flemish, and if she was elected, she'd be the first female prime minister to Belgium, and she's got a nickname as Iron Maggie, reminiscent of another Iron Lady in the UK, because of her strong policies on immigration. But she's also a very sort of humorous character. She's got the common touch. So she's vastly popular among Belgians. So at the moment, she's one of the few frontrunners for the post.
And how are Belgian media and Belgian people reacting to this? Have they grown quite accustomed to the idea of, you know, just nobody being in charge and yet the sun still coming up in the morning and water coming out of the taps?
Yes, surprisingly, when I opened the Belgian media in the morning, when I look at the websites, and look at the newspapers, and it's often not on the front pages. It's often tucked away inside a little bit of coalition negotiations, whereas I can't imagine many other countries where 116 days without a government wouldn't be massive news. But yes, certainly the political complexities of Belgium with that north-south divide, I think people have come to expect it, and they'll be positively beaming at the prospect of a government in such a short space of time.
I did also want to ask about an exceptionally peculiar local story, which is that Belgium, like every other member of the European Union, does not have capital punishment by law, but you have a prisoner effectively volunteering for execution.
I know, it's an extraordinary story. So this man, he is a convicted rapist and murderer by the name of Frank van der Bleeken. And what he did earlier this week was successfully petition the government to allow him to be euthanized. Now, Belgium has some of the most liberal euthanasia laws in the world, and a panel of doctors can agree with a person who requests euthanasia because they're suffering from unbearable and irreversible mental or physical anguish. So he argued it under the mental anguish aspect, saying he would never be able to be cured, he was destined for a life in prison, therefore it would be better for him to die. And quite extraordinarily, the Ministry of Justice agreed with him and have approved that request. So it's opened up a whole debate here about whether or not the state should be offering better treatment or better care for prisoners rather than approving their requests to die.
What would be the mechanics of this? Because, as I was saying, obviously Belgium, like every other European country, has no capacity or facility for executing prisoners. How would this actually work?
It would work the same as anybody else who takes this option in Belgium. It has become increasingly not popular is the wrong word, but it's accepted here. Something like 1,400 people every year choose euthanasia. And what happens, it's doctors administer sedatives, usually in the comfort of a person's own home, but it depends on the person's wishes. So what this prisoner has, he's been given permission from the Ministry of Justice to have 48 hours to leave prison, 48 hours before the euthanasia it takes place, to be with his friends and family. So it would be the same process for him as it would be for any other Belgian who takes this option.
It should be remembered, of course, that, you know, Frank van den Bleeken has committed terrible crimes. There's probably an objective argument that he's frankly no great loss. But do Belgian people think this is potentially getting us into a bit of a weird area, or are most people okay with this?
Well, I was quite surprised because the debate did seem to focus on this issue of whether or not there should be better care for prisoners. I think, again, if this had come up in some other countries, like Britain, for example, would have been quite a scandal, really. You know, somebody just deciding they didn't want to serve their sentence, sort of capital punishment by another name. But the euthanasia laws have been in place in Belgium since 2000, and I think it's 2002 now, so they've been in place for a long time, and people have got used to them. So they don't cause as much of an outcry as you might expect. I mean, they were extended to apply to children earlier this year, and that caused outrage around the world, but not here. The debate is very rational, it's very calm, it's not overly emotional. So it really, yeah, as I said, the debate is about prison conditions now rather than the actual act of euthanasia, which is fascinating.
Charlotte McDonald-Gibson in Brussels, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll be going to Pennsylvania for a spot of David Lynch.
The weekly culture show on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show.
I look at it and I think, God, could I have really lived like that? Could it really been me? But I know that it was, so I do connect with it.
Culture is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you didn't know you wanted to get to know, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take five times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, coming up for 1842 in London. Most of us know David Lynch for his eerie and dreamlike films like Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive, and the innovative television series Twin Peaks, which inspired an entire genre of Too Clever by Half meditations on the darkness and weirdness lurking behind the picket fences of American suburbia, etc. Fewer of us know that before David Lynch got into movies, he was a promising student at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts. This month, the Academy is showcasing 90 of his paintings and drawings dating from 1965, along with some of his more recent works. A bit earlier, Nancy Durham caught up with Robert Cozzolino, curator of modern art at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts. Robert began by walking us through what to expect at the exhibit.
It is an exhibition that really focuses on his development as a painter and a draftsman, going from about 1965 up until 2013. The thing that's really key about all of this, and what I really wanted to do with David's work, is to either remind people or tell them who just know him as a filmmaker that painting has really been the through line in David Lynch's work from the beginning. He started off in high school as a painter. It's what his first love was, and he's never stopped. He never put it on the back burner or took a divergent route that was just filmmaking. It's always been parallel, and it's sort of synced up with his work every once in a while. I think you could see that in the sensibility of his film.
Tell us about the style. I mean, I'm looking at pictures here, or you know, images of his art. It's very varied. The colors are, there's an amazing range, the shapes, the human figures. Could you describe what he does for us?
Sure. One of the most remarkable things to me is that we had access to so much of his early work that he did when he was not only a student at the Pennsylvania Academy, which he was only really a student of advanced painting for about a year and a half, and then remained in Philadelphia until the middle of 1970 before going to L.A. as a fellow in a prestigious film program, and that's, of course, where he made Eraserhead. But, you know, the thing that's really, I think, important about him is that what you see in those early works, which are dark, often experimenting with materials that aren't just his oil paints or acrylics, but adding cigarette filters and horsehair and other kinds of things, even sculptural masks that are relief casts of his face. He's trying all sorts of things out in three dimensions, not just sort of making a flat surface. So he's trying to give a kind of tangibility to his work that creates another world, and I think that's the kind of quality that he's always talked about wanting art to give the viewer, that you're entering into another world. And that kind of sculptural quality continues throughout the rest of his career as a painter. In fact, you're kind of hard-pressed to consider the later work, especially the large-scale, 9-foot-wide paintings of like 2009, 2010, as simply paintings. They're sculptural objects. There's light bulbs that protrude out of them that actually light up. And they're presented in these massive frames that make them seem like they're either on stages or behind windows.
I'm looking at one. There's a middle-class family. It's a beautiful painting, standing around looking at the dinner table, and there's an enormous head on it.
There's an early drawing that's pretty astonishing that's presented for the first time that he did while he was working on Eraserhead from 1974 that has these graphite drawing of an interior that really does look like some of those dark interiors from Eraserhead with a family of creatures that look like a combination of anteaters or I don't know what. You know, he's got this interest actually consistently throughout his work in the home and domestic settings.
And that was Robert Cozzolino, curator of modern art at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, with Monocle's Nancy Durham a bit earlier. And it's time now for some music on Midori House. And seeing as how we were just talking about David Lynch's non-cinematic art, here's some more of it. Co-written by Lynch from the soundtrack of Twin Peaks. This is Julie Cruise with Falling. Julie Cruise with Falling, which kind of serves as a bridge between our previous item, which was about David Lynch, who does, of course, make films, and our next item, which is about films, because we've reached that point on Midori House where we discuss some aspect or other of the week's culture, and to give away the ending this week, it is cinema, and we're joined once again by Anna Smith, film critic, acting film reviews editor for Metro. Anna, welcome back.
Thank you.
First of all, a film I have not yet seen, but I'm very much looking forward to. This is 20,000 Days on Earth, the kind of life story of Nick Cave.
Yes, I'd highly recommend it, actually. It's a very interesting experimental documentary, but far from pretentious, which is actually quite a difficult thing to achieve. It tells a fictional day in the life of Nick Cave, in theory his 20,000th day on Earth, but it's all very stylized. It's made by a couple of art house kind of filmmakers, Ian Forsyth and Jane Pollard, and they follow him as he goes from the studio with Warren Ellis into these kind of contrived sessions with a psychiatrist. So he's sharing genuine recollections, but in this very staged, beautifully lit setup. And they've also got Kylie popping in, Ray Winston popping in as he drives around, or, you know, pretends to drive around his hometown of Brighton. But it's really rather fascinating.
I have interviewed Cave myself once many years ago, and it was at once one of the most difficult interviews I've ever done, but also one of the best, because he clearly hates being interviewed, doesn't like journalists. It was quite strange. There was no conversational aspect to it at all. I would ask him a question, he would think, answer, and then stop and wait for the next question, which was excruciating, as you can imagine. But when I actually then typed up the transcript, it was fantastic. Everything he said was interesting or funny or perceptive or etc.
That's very interesting. And I think that's what they've used in this. They've used some fantastically interesting quotes from him. He's a really obviously very intelligent man, very creative and very eccentric. And they've used those as a form of narration and sort of picked and chosen the best ones. And it's kind of hypnotic.
We do have a clip from this. This is from 20,000 Days on Earth.
I write. I eat.
I probably had more meals with you than my wife.
I watch TV.
Also,
this is my 20,000th day on Earth.
Darian's ready to see you now.
What's your earliest memory of a female body?
Huh?
What do you fear the most?
It does worry me that I'm not going to be able to continue to do what I do and reach a place that I'm satisfied with.
In a sense?
Because memory is what we are. Your very soul and your very reason to be alive is tied up in memory.
20,000 Days on Earth featuring the great Nick Cave there. What impression do you end up taking away of him as a human being?
I think you think that he's a real one-off. I mean, he's eccentric, difficult, probably really impossible in many ways, but admirable at the same time, and someone that oddly you can relate to, even though he's a very unusual man, because of the personal level of what he shares. And it very much invites self-reflection. You don't necessarily have to be a big fan of Nick Cave or even his music to appreciate the kind of level of humanity that he's exposing.
And just finally on this one, because it's always been a personal conviction of mine about Cave as a fellow Australian expatriate, I do often suspect that a lot of listeners to his work in the Northern Hemisphere don't quite realise how funny he is. There's a very dry edge to his humour, which translates quite well in Australia, but maybe not as well overseas.
I think it does translate, and I think that's a really good point. That's one of the things that stops this film becoming pretentious. It's not sort of very serious. He has a lovely, dry, dark sense of humour, which really works.
Okay, well, moving on from the Australian artist to a film about possibly some of the least Australian people you could possibly imagine. This is Riot Club. Mm-hmm. It's a fictionalised take on the Bullingdon Club, which is an Oxford University dining society, which has become notorious largely due to one photograph.
That's right.
Which contains both a young David Cameron and a young Boris Johnson radiating the sort of kind of utter entitlement that does provoke a certain amount of blind fury in a large part of the British electorate. How have they gone about doing this?
Well, it's a film of several parts, really. On the way, it's based on a stage play called Posh, which was all about this dinner which spiralled out of control, where, you know, these terribly entitled men were throwing their money around and their weight around and everything went horribly wrong. But it kind of bookends that with a new part of script. And I liked the filmic bits much more than the play, actually. The Freshers' Week at the beginning when this Max Irons plays the new fresher who's trying to downplay his poshness but is secretly really thrilled to be approached by these guys.
On the subject of inherited privilege, he is, of course, the son of Jeremy Irons.
Exactly, he would know. And he's having a romance with Holiday Granger, who's much more down to earth, and all that's really well done. But then when they get to this dinner party, it suddenly feels incredibly theatrical, go figure. But you know, you've got these very vile caricatures of the posh people that you just cease to believe in. They just seem very scripted.
They sort of like fall into that, because it is very easy to caricature the English upper classes.
It is. They're not like anyone you ever met, even if you've hung out with posh people. They're just too extreme, I think. And then also, by the same token, the working class pub landlord is just sort of wringing his hands and sort of kowtowing to them the whole time.
He actually have a flat cap and tug his forelock?
Almost, yes. It's almost that bad. So it's a bit of a shame, and it has a lot of merit in terms of the performances and the way it's filmed, but I think in the script it leaves you feeling a little bit cheated and a little bit sort of depressed, but not in a way that's particularly profound.
Because it is really hard to sustain drama about, or any kind of thing really, about basically terrible characters if you can't find anything to sympathise with. I mean, it may just be me. That was always my problem with Mad Men. I just found myself sitting there thinking, why am I watching this? These people are all awful.
Yes, you may well have that problem, or slightly more of a problem with The Riot Club, I think.
And I suspect I may have even more of a problem with the next film that you wanted to talk about, Magic in the Moonlight. And I have to say, having read the top few lines of the notes, a romantic comedy by Woody Allen set in French Riviera of the 1920s, starring Colin Firth. This is again, I am reaching for my pitchfork and I am grasping it tightly.
Well, on the one hand, there is that, but then on the other hand, there's some people that's going to sound attractive too, right? It's Woody Allen at his so-so, not at his best and not at his worst, thank heavens. But Emma Stone also appears, and as usual, you've got a very, you know, much older guy and a much younger woman, you know, Woody Allen's tradition.
In a Woody Allen film, yes. Imagine.
Exactly. I liked the idea of it. The idea is that he's a stage illusionist who likes to defraud well-known psychics, and he tries to unmask this medium, but of course finds himself desperately attracted to her. But it starts to get quite boring.
Okay, we do have a hopefully not boring clip of it.
Mr. Davenger is rather obnoxious.
But he's not entirely unappealing.
I understand you're holding a seance tonight.
The planets are in alignment.
Now I will summon the unseen world.
Give us a sign.
The more I watch her, the more I'm stumped.
Could she be real? I'm beginning to question my own common sense.
You've always been so certain about the world, and I've always tried to teach you that we don't know.
Tell me something about my Aunt Vanessa's colourful past.
I see a member of Parliament.
Go on.
A love affair.
You cannot possibly know this.
God, that sounds ghastly. Magic in the Moonlight, the new Woody Allen film. Boring, you think?
Eventually quite boring, yes.
Okay. Yep. Very finally, and unfortunately extremely briskly, Philip Noyce's The Giver.
The Giver. This is a young adult novel made into a sci-fi. It's Logan's Run light, with handsome young men, but not much substance.
On that note, Anna Smith, thank you very much. Anna Smith from Metro, Acting Films Reviews Editor at Metro. And that is all for this edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our earlier special guests, Tim Marshall and John Everard. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Rebecca Unger. Our studio manager was Joel Church. After the headlines, The Menu, our food and drink show presented by Marcus Hippie. At 2200, I'm back with Nancy Durham for The Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday. But for this edition of Midori House, from me, Andrew Miller, it's goodbye, and thanks for listening.
Tao Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam, a Bogota,
to Hong Kong,
all around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.